I am not an expert. I've never published a book or taught a class. I've never even put anything in a quilt show. But I love quilting, and I love talking about quilting. I make a lot of mistakes, but I like to think that sometimes I learn from them and get just a little bit better. If hearing about someone else's goofs and mess-ups makes you feel better about yours, then I've done my job. Join me as we talk about quilting for the rest of us. Hey, I'm Sandy, and I'm a quilter, and I'm back. Boy, does it feel good to be healthy again. That one was a doozy. Now I'm back to just feeling kind of my normal allergy self for this time of year. A little sniffly, but otherwise I can survive. Health is sometimes undervalued. You know, we think about the big diseases, but when we're in the midst of a flu that just drags on, you just wonder if what it feels like to ever be healthy again. That was kind of where I was at by the end of last week. But this week's been much better. I'm glad to say I'm over whatever that was. I even got out tonight and got some plants in the ground that had been screaming at me because I didn't get them in soon enough. Hopefully they will survive, but I am just very happy to be back to normal. This episode is going to be a lot of fun to do. I'm going to get back into doing listener comments. That was probably what I missed the most while I was not in good voice, and I've got some comments to catch up on now. So we're going to be spending some time with the listeners. I'll give you a little bit of an update about what I've been up to. And then I'm going to talk about a quilt that almost ended up in the trash several times during its life cycle. So welcome to episode 17, in which I save a quilt from almost certain destruction. Hopefully this is one of those episodes in which you will learn from my mistakes and not have to make them yourself. So let's get on to listener comments. Let's see, I think I'm going to start chronologically backwards. We have a couple of new listeners who have been starting from the beginning and are just now catching up, and I am thrilled to know that. So I'd like to give a shout out to new listener Lauren. Woohoo! Thank you for joining the party. And Lauren commented on episode 3, in which I face a few fundamental truths. She particularly enjoyed talking about the rules, and she said, "One that seems to be nearly absolute for me is that any quilt that is to be given as a gift will have one block that is sewn together backwards or put into the quilt upside down, and this will be discovered in the process of quilting. Of course, by then, fixing the error is nigh on to impossible, so that you then rehearse your speech about the charm of homemade things and how it is their imperfections that make them the most beautiful. I actually found a mistake in one of my quilts as I was admiring it hanging in a show with a blue ribbon on it. On that occasion, I thought it best to accept compliments graciously and otherwise keep my mouth shut." Thank you, Lauren, for sharing that. That gave me a good laugh and then sent me into a coughing fit, but that's okay. I enjoyed the laugh before that. And episode 4, Jay, who's actually been a listener for a while, but she's got to be maybe backtracking and catching up. Episode 4 was the one in which I evaluated my stash, and Jay mentioned that the basics that she was thinking about were that she doesn't use many neutrals, and she actually considers hot pink and turquoise to be neutrals. She says, "I know that gorgeous quilts can be made with all different colors, prints, and designs, and I will admire the ones I wouldn't make just as eagerly as the quilts made from brights." Jay is an equal opportunity admirer, apparently, and I would love to see your stash, Jay. I imagine it would really wake me up on a bleary, bleary morning. Thanks for that comment. Terry is also a new listener. Another shout out. Woohoo, Terry! Thanks for coming on. And Terry just listened to episode 11, in which we get colorful. And she gave some very nice comments, and then she mentioned that she was going to be spending a little time at her mountain house in Northern California sewing, quilting, and creating. And might I just say, Terry, I am really envious, and I want to come! So if I show up on your front door, don't be surprised. Terry also mentioned that she has played with the colorschemer.com. If you remember, I had mentioned that in that episode, and you can still find the link to it if you scroll down in the show notes to that episode. That is a lot of fun to play with, even if you don't really have anything particularly in mind, so I would encourage you to all go check that out. Let's see, now we're up to episode 15, in which we go shopping. Robin commented that she wants yards and yards of everything, and she's not even working on anything right now. And Robin, feel free, you just go ahead and do that, regardless of what anybody might tell you, because we are all about buying fabric. Have fun with that. And Jane also commented on episode 15, and apparently she listened to it as she was doing some online fabric shopping. So that was perfect timing. And she was looking for doing the half yard cuts of everything, which is part of what I had suggested because at least that's what I do. Whether or not that's right for you is up to you. Pardon me, I just had to go throw my dog out of my office. She is driving me nuts, and I'm sorry that you had to hear her bark too. In any case, back to the listener comments. Jane did mention that she, while she was internet shopping and she was trying to do the half yard cut, she ended up finding the Café Fawcett fabrics and she wound up with an order chock full of them. Those are hard to resist, so you have my sympathies. And obviously, we will have to see pictures when you do actually use them. Anybody that mentions a particular fabric to me, by the way, I want to see pictures when you use it, even if it's years from now, because I like pictures. Let's see. Now we're up to episode 16, the most recent one in which I chat with a long arm quilter. Sarah of Stash Resolution fame and Francis of Off Quilter Quilt fame both appreciated the conversation with Tara Tom, long arm quilter, and both of you sent me well wishes, and I really appreciate it. Apparently they worked. Thank you, both of you. And I have been holding off on listening to any other quilt podcasters' quilt podcasts lately because I'm going to be driving for several hours through really boring expressway countryside on Tuesday, and I am looking forward to catching up on all my own quilt podcast listening at that point. And I know both Stash Resolution and Off Kilter Quilt have a couple of episodes in my iPod, so I'm looking forward to that. And Jane also commented on episode 16, and she mentioned that she was listening while she was packing to move. Jane, you have my sympathies. The first 7 years my husband and I were married, we moved six different times, and we're not even in the military. That was just changing from one apartment to the other. And I hate moving with a passion, so you've got my well wishes going with you. Let us know how it goes once you're moved. I also want to say thanks to Anne for leaving a comment on my quiltingfortherestofus.blogspot.com blog. For those of you who haven't had a chance to watch it yet, I posted a really interesting video of an artist that works in an extremely transitory medium. The video really made me think, and I posted a couple of questions with the video, so you might want to go check that out. And that one's at my quiltingfortherestofus.blogspot.com blog. And remember, you can find a link to that from thequilter.podbean.com. So again, if you only can remember one thing, quilter.podbean.com is the one to remember. We have some new entries in the You Know You're a Quilter When game. These are always a hoot for me to get, so thank you. Linda said, "You know you're a quilter when you recognize geographical locations by quilt shops, not city and state." And you know what? I have a droid that I've had for about a month now, and it's got this great program called Footprints, and I can actually take pictures of a front door, and it puts the GPS location, and I can leave comments and the address and all that kind of stuff, so I can find it again. And guess what is mostly in that Footprints program now? It's all quilt shops. It's a lot of fun. Terry said, "You know you're a quilter when all empty food containing packaging is considered for quilting supply storage." And Terry also said, "You know you're a quilter when your husband picks threads off your back in public places." Yeah, I've gone to church and been sitting there and found threads on me. And, you know, I'm only slightly embarrassed, but most of me figures, it is what it is. Lauren said, "You know you're a quilter when your Farmville farm is laid out as a nine patch." You know, that reminded me, I think it was maybe in Quilter's Home. I don't remember now. It was one of the quilt magazines had this whole article about this sort of competition that was going on with quilters in Farmville and the way that they were designing their different farms. I actually sold my farm. Not literally. I just quit because I couldn't keep up with the darn thing, and I wasn't even trying to get fancy with it. Let's see. Loretta said, "You know you're a quilter when you want to see everyone else's stash and sewing room when you visit their house, and you don't care how messy it is. You also know that your area in your own house is in the same disarray." Thank you to all of you for leaving You Know You're a Quilter When, and keep them coming. I really enjoy those, and I enjoy being able to share them with the other listeners. I got an email this week from Gretchen, and I told her I wasn't going to answer her question in email. I said it was a great question to bring up, and I would respond to it on this episode. Gretchen said, You have talked quite a bit on your podcast about getting rid of fabric from your mom that you didn't want. What was the best way you found to do so? Now, Gretchen did mention donation. She was also hoping that maybe she could earn some money off the stash. Who wouldn't want to? Because then what do we get to do? Go out and buy more. But in any case, I thought it was a great question, and I will let you know just what we did and the different ways we took care of the fabric. And I have a couple of other ideas for making money. We chose it. For me, it was more about trying to get rid of the fabric as quickly as possible and not so much earning the money on it, since I hadn't spent the money on it in the first place. So we did mostly donate. The first thing, when Mom was still alive, we actually went through the process of trying to downsize her stash because she thought she might actually move into a smaller house. She was looking to downsize. And at that point, we just went through all of her fabric. And I gave it to my BFF BQF, Kate, that I've mentioned before, and she went through it and took what she wanted to, and then she took hers, the rest of it, to a quilt guild. She's part of a very, very large quilt guild in our area, and they have, I think it's just a donation table that they do, and so she was able to just bring it and offload it, and I think she got rid of it all in 1 week. And that was not, I mean, that was a significant amount of fabric, but part of the reason we did it that way was because Mom was really at that point getting rid of her older fabric and some of her non-quilter's cotton fabric, you know, some of the stuff she had from her seamstress days and that kind of thing. Then after she passed away, my sister and I both went through the fabric and took what we wanted to first. And then I called up Mom's quilt friends, her group of best quilt friends there, and invited them to come over and take what they wanted to, which they really appreciated. They felt a little funny about it at first, but then they realized how much this would be part of their memory of Mom. And in the year since that happened, actually, two of them have sent me photos of quilts they have made with Mom's fabric. And so that was really meaningful to me as well. Then once everybody had gone through and took what they wanted to, we did put the fabric into the estate sale. I had originally intended to try to do a garage sale myself up here where I live, because I have more ready access to quilt guilds around me than where my mom lived, and I thought I'd get probably more people showing up that actually knew what this stuff was worth, but I just didn't have the time. And so after loading all the stuff in my car and bringing it and putting it all in my basement, actually like three trips because there was a lot of it, I ended up loading it all in my car and bringing it back out to Mom's house and just including it in the same estate sale where all the rest of the household goods that we were not going to keep were sold. And I'm sure, you know, it went for cents on the dollar, if even that much. I'm sure it did not sell for what it was really worth, but for the idea of not having me to take the time to do that was also, you know, time is money in some cases. And then there was still some left over. Mom had an enormous stash. I can't even begin to describe this. So even after the estate sale and all of us had gone through it, there was still a fair amount of fabric and other tools, notions, and gadgets left over. And so at that point, I did some research. I donated some that was larger yardage to the refugee community in my city, because many of the women are seamstresses and could make their own window coverings and some clothing for children and things like that. So I took the larger chunks of fabric, you know, that was multiple yards, and donated some of that. And then the rest of it I took to a consignment store. There's a craft consignment store in my area that will take craft supplies and fabric and that sort of thing and sells it, and then the funds go to charity. I believe it's a senior living community kind of thing, or senior programming in that town where the consignment shop is located. And so that felt good to me, because I knew not only was I then selling this, I probably shouldn't call it a consignment shop, because I did not get any income from it. I donated it. And once they sold it, then the income went to their charity, and that felt good to me. If you want to be able to sell fabric, there's always Craigslist, and you could list fabric. I would strongly suggest, if you use Craigslist, that you make up an email address or something so that your personal information can't be traced. I know Craigslist also, they create sort of identities, but eventually you are going to have to be in touch with this person to arrange meeting them. So do what you can to protect your own privacy, and then only meet in a public spot. Don't have somebody come to your house and go through your stash. load it up into a bin and meet him at a Starbucks or something so that you're protecting your own identity or safety, that kind of thing. But Craigslist would be a good way to do that. Some communities also have community-wide garage sales. Sometimes, like a public library, you can rent out a table and, you know, for $25 or whatever, and then you can be part of this community garage sale. That might be a way to look at it. So those are a couple of ideas. That's how I dealt with my mom's fabric, and those are a couple of ideas I had for ways that you could maybe earn some income off of the fabric. But this is something I would open up to all the listeners. If anybody else has ever downsized their stash and has some creative ideas about donating, where you might donate it, or how you might earn some money off of it, please leave your own comments. You can either do it in the show notes to this episode, or if you're part of the Big Tent community, we can talk about it there too. So let Gretchen know. You know, what have you found that works, or what ideas might you have to share with her, even if you've not done it yourself? Okay, remember the creativity challenge. And we do already have a couple of people who are looking to do the creativity challenge. In fact, a couple of people have left comments. Jill says she's in for the summer challenge, although she has no idea what or how or what size. She'll probably fall into an idea, which she says seems to be the way I've ended up in many places in my life. And I'm doing the same thing. I think I've got an idea, but partly it depends on how much time I have, because as usual, my idea is probably more grandiose than what I'll actually have time to pull off, but I'll try. And Anne has impressed us all, because Anne said, and I want to share this with you because this was cool. The first time she saw the gorilla, she thought, wow, this will be just a little weird, because I warned you. But like I mentioned, she got into the gorilla's eyes. She was taken by their expression of love and also its position to receive love, and that's inspired her design. Now, I just got the biggest chuckle out of that because, Anne, I did not interpret the gorilla's face to look, the eyes to look loving. I actually found them to be a little more, I don't know, annoyed. What are you doing, human, with that camera kind of thing? So it's funny to me how different people can interpret the same photo, too. If anybody else is looking at that photo, I'd love to hear what you think the gorilla is thinking. And Anne has already charted out her blocks. She's already picking out fabric, and I believe I've already seen a picture of what she's doing. Her original plans were a really large wall hanging. So everybody, we got to get on board and we got to keep up with Anne. So anyway, join in the fun. You've got time. Look at the picture of the gorilla. See what he inspires you to do. And just for a little extra inspiration, I posted a video that I ran across last week. In my sickness, all I could do was sit around and watch a little bit of YouTube here and there, so I found this great video, and I posted it on that same page. So go to quilter.podbean.com and click on Creativity Challenge. What have I been up to? I was sick. Not up to much. Have not touched needle and thread, and certainly not sewing machine. But you know what I did do? I started a newsletter, so you can subscribe. I'm going to do a very short and monthly e-newsletter by email for a companion newsletter for this podcast series, and it's going to have a few more tips, some product reviews, and links to other goodness for your quilty pleasure. Not your guilty pleasure, but it could be. That's up to you. So if you go to quilter.podbean.com, and look on the right-hand menu under the word links, you will see subscribe to the e-newsletter right above subscribe to the Big Tent group. Sometimes they switch positions, so one might be on top of the other. I don't know why it's doing that. They keep kind of flipping back and forth. But in any case, both subscription links are right next to each other. If you're already a member of the Quilting for the Rest of Us group in Big Tent, I've also posted a subscription link in the news entry there. And here's your carrot. The first 25 people to subscribe will have their names entered in a drawing for some really wonderful fat quarters. Remember the shop hop I was just on recently? Well, I was thinking of y'all, and I was buying presents, and I can't wait to give them away. So subscribe to the newsletter, and if you're one of the first 25 people, your name will get put in an entry for me to draw for a winner to get some fat quarters. Okay, I think that's all of my intro kind of stuff. And that's not bad. I actually got through that a little more quickly than I thought I would because I was so far behind. I must be talking a little extra fast today, for which I apologize. Okay, Episode 17, in which I save a quilt from almost certain destruction. This all had to do with a class I took for an entire year at my local quilt shop. It was called Sisters in a Square, and that was the name of the class. It was based on Jody Barrow's Square in a Square technique. Now, I took this class because Peg Oppenheimer, who is an area teacher, who is a certified Jody Barrow's certified Square in a Square instructor, she came to our quilt guild one day and she did a trunk show, and she was a hoot, first of all. Peg is just really funny, really warm, very friendly. I thoroughly enjoyed her trunk show, and I just mostly just wanted to take a class with her. I thought it just sounded like a lot of fun. I didn't care really what the technique was. I would have taken a class with her. But the premise of the class did look interesting. When she did the trunk show, her quilts were just gorgeous. First of all, she's got a real eye for color, which I just enjoyed looking at the way she was putting colors together. But the quilts themselves, the patterns were very pretty. And she was talking about how fast this technique is. And, you know, I'm all about fast. I don't have a whole lot of time to quilt. And so anything that will give me wonderful, beautiful results in a shorter period of time, a lot of times is very appealing to me. Not always. Sometimes I do like to take a little bit of time with the process. But again, not a lot of time to be able to take. So after that trunk show, I thought the premise looked interesting. I thought it would be fun to take a class with her. And that worked. Okay, that was definitely the upside to the class. The second reason I decided to take the class is it had actually been a while at the time that I first started taking that, signed up for the class. It had been a while since I'd taken an actual physical class, and I really thought having a monthly commitment would make sure that I was doing at least a little quilting every month, regardless of what else was going on. And at that time, this was a couple of years ago now when I started that class. At that time, I had a lot going on at work. My kids were a little bit younger, so I was ferrying them all over the place, and I was not spending a whole lot of quality time with my sewing machine. And I thought, you know, if I make that monthly commitment for a year, at least that's one night and doing the homework that I know I will be getting done. And that worked, too. It really did. The third reason is I found out that several other members of my guild were taking the same class, and I thought that would be a really good way to get to know a few of them better, and that really worked too. It was fun being in a class month after month with people that I already sort of knew but was getting to know better, and then I was also seeing them every month at our guild meetings, and we were comparing notes on the process and everything, so that was a really good experience. It also seemed like a really good technique, and I am always game to try out something new that would either improve my accuracy, would improve my speed, or would just be a fun new technique to learn. Now, this one, I'm still not sure. My jury's still out. I'll talk to you a little bit more about that in a minute. And then the final reason was I thought it would be a good way to get used to using scraps. At that point in my life, I don't know, I probably had done a scrap quilt somewhere along the way, but it wasn't really my idiom, as we can say, and I really wanted to try to push myself a little bit in that direction. So when I started the class, I designated a set of coordinating fat quarters that I had for years. They were actually the Moto Chocolat series. I loved that collection of fat quarters. I think I had maybe 10 or 12 of them to start with. It was a fairly sizable stack, and I decided I would use those for this class. What I didn't really realize is they weren't going to last me that long. By the third month, I was already having to go out and find more coordinating fabrics because I was starting to run short on the ones that I had on those fat quarters. So the class, in and of itself, if nothing else, was an excellent lesson for me in how to pull together fabrics from a variety of places in a way that they'd work together. And I also pushed myself on using, you know, making different decisions. If I thought, well, I need three fabrics for this block this month. Here's three I know would work. Let me take one of them out and put in something I wouldn't normally choose. And that was a really good experience to do that too. So that was pretty much my reasoning for taking the class itself. If you're not familiar with the square in a square technique, let me try to describe it briefly if I can. It is a fairly simple technique. In and of itself. Basically, you cut a center square and then you cut strips and you sew the square to the strips chain piecing around two sides. You trim them and then you strip the square on the other two sides and you trim it and you've got a square and a square. And that method is called stripping the square. And you start out pretty much every option. The technique is based on multiple options, and I lost track. There's 30 some odd, maybe 40 options. There may even be more than that. And each one's based on that same basic start, is you have your center square. In some cases, as you get more advanced, you actually start with a diamond to get a different effect. But you start with that centerpiece, you strip around two sides, trim it up, you strip around the other two sides, and then depending on what option you're choosing to use, you might continue to add additional strips. You might cut what you've already done, in half or in quarters, kind of mix it up. You might do a combo package. There's a lot of variety once you get into it. So you're using the same basic technique over and over again, but using different types of cutting, different sizes, different times you go around, you get very different effects. And some of them were really cool. I mean, that was kind of fun. My favorite one was one where you strip the square two or three times and then you cut it. I believe you cut it in, as an X, you cut it diagonally both ways, and then you flip it all around so that you're attaching it backwards, and it turns out beautiful. It was a lot of fun to do that one. So a little hard to describe, but it's really a fairly simple premise to start with, so it doesn't take that long to learn. There are a lot of books in the series. Some newer books are revised from older versions, so if you decide to look this up, just kind of watch for cues of which version you might be getting. Some of them, again, I mentioned some more advanced ones start with diamonds rather than squares, which should give you a completely different effect. But there are a variety of books all based on the same premise. So if you're just starting out and if this is something you want to look into, you'll want to get one of the basic books first. And I believe the basic book that we used was Advancing on the Square 2, because it was actually a revision of the original book. I don't quote me on that though. I'd have to go dig through my bookshelf to find them, because I actually now, between the books I had bought when Peg did her trunk show and ones I inherited from my mom, I now have, I think, the complete set, even the ones that are out of print. I ended up with all of them. So I don't really remember exactly which one is, but you can sort that out when you're on the website. And then there's a specialty ruler. For the class we took, we really only needed one ruler. There's a couple different ones you can use, but there's one main one. And it worked really well. It would be, I don't know that you could do this technique without that ruler. You might be able to. You'd have to do some math and figure out where to do it. But the ruler makes it very simple, because you just line up certain lines for certain cuts, and you don't really even have to think about it too much. Once you know which line you're using, you just kind of whip through and do them all at once. And I don't remember the rulers being any more expensive than any regular, OmniGrid or Creative Grid rulers are. So, definitely, if you're going to do it, do yourself a favor, get the book, get the ruler, start out with the tools, because otherwise you'll just be frustrated. I've already mentioned the class itself was a hoot. If any of you are in the area and ever have a chance to take a class with Peg Oppenheimer, she is a great teacher. It was a great way to get to know some of the folks in my guild better. It was also a lot of fun to see how very different all of our quilts turned out, even though we were all doing the same blocks, but we were all using different colors, and the way we put them together, and certainly the way we set them at the end was all very different. So that was a lot of fun. And it was really good to have a monthly quilting commitment. And I'm very proud of myself, because in that entire year, I only missed one class, and that was because that was the week my mother passed away. But other than that, every other month, I actually made it to class a couple times. I came tearing in at the absolute last minute, but I got there, and even just being there was a good experience. So again, go back and listen to my class to episode 13, in which we get classy, where I talk about why you take classes. I really firmly believe in that. So again, though, on the sister, sorry, on the square and the square technique, my personal jury is still out on it. I didn't fall in love with the technique, but I also haven't completely discounted it yet. There were a couple of people in the class that absolutely loved the method, just fell in love with it, thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. There were a couple of others that I don't think even finished the class because they decided they hated the method. It's kind of one of those methods that seems to draw strong feelings. I'm not entirely sure why. Most of us, I think, came out where we were willing to give it some more time. We weren't positive that we were fully in love with the method, but we hadn't fully decided against it either. The way I see it, and I'm not a certified square and a square instructor, so somebody else might describe this differently, but the way I see it, the two main benefits to the method are speed and simplicity. Although the way we were doing the blocks, Peg had designed the blocks we did, it wasn't particularly fast. They were very complex blocks, which I didn't even have sink into my head until partway through the year. I kept thinking, why are these blocks taking so long? And then a friend of mine looked at them and said, wow, those are really complex blocks. And when I looked at it, I thought, wow, you're right. They really are kind of complicated. So, it took us longer. But I think if I was doing an entire quilt using maybe one or just two of the options, it probably would go really fast because it's just a chain system that you're kind of whipping through all of these things. I think that would be a much faster technique. Now, the two main drawbacks to the method would be one, all the bias edges you end up with, and I'll talk about more about that later. And then the second drawback is fabric waste. When you strip the square, you then trim a fair amount of that fabric off. Now, me, I'm willing to waste a little fabric if I gain in speed or accuracy, and that's where my own jury is still out. If I can do it again, and if I become convinced that, yeah, really the speed and or the accuracy is the thing, then okay, I'll do it. Because technically, the reason I'm talking about accuracy is technically you're doing everything slightly larger than you need to and then trimming it down to size. But the bias edges then kind of mess with that theory a little bit. I will list the website for the square and the square technique for Jody Barrow's square and the square technique so you can check it out more yourself. It's going to be in the show notes, and I'm also going to put it in this month's newsletter so you can see it there as well. Now, for this class, we were to have done 4 6-inch blocks each month so that by the end of the class, we would have had 48 blocks to work with altogether. My mom passed away right before the ninth class, and I didn't finish the rest of the months. I went to the class every month. I just couldn't get the blocks done because we were then, engaged in trying to get my mom's house on the market. And then there was one. Somewhere in there was also another month's of blocks that just gave me fits trying to get them together, and I ended up giving up on them. So I think I finished 1 month after, and then in any case, I ended up only with 9 months worth of blocks. But to tell the truth, that gave me a plenty big quilt to work with. I believe my quilt is probably just about twin size just with that number of blocks, so I was happy with that. Putting the quilt together was a lesson in surmounting one problem after another. Just about every juncture in the process, I was really ready to bag the whole thing and send the blocks off into fabric mistake heaven. But something in me just wouldn't quite give up on it. Part of that was the deadline of the classes every month. And then Peg had asked us all to bring our finished piece tops to a guild meeting the following November. Mine were still just pieced to my design wall. I hadn't actually gotten them put together at that point. But that, gives you that deadline and gives you that goal. And so I did keep plugging away at it. I started out hating the entire thing, and by the end of it, I ended up ponying up to have it custom quilted. So obviously, somewhere along the way, I fell in love with this. So here's the saga. Problem number one, I had problems making the blocks each month. The first issue I kept having was I kept having the wrong quantity of fabric, and I think that was probably my own math. Every month, Peg would give us the list of the fabric requirements for the block and the instructions, and we would then go and do it on our own. And every single time, I was short on fabric, every single time. And I really think that was my own math and how I was figuring it out. Part of it was because hers was based on full width of fabric, and I was using fat quarters, so I was having to double everything up, and I don't think it was quite exactly double. In any case, a couple of times I ran out of fabric when I had 3 out of the 4 blocks done, or had most of them cut, and so the blocks ended up being even more scrappy than I originally intended. But the beauty of a scrap quilt is you don't even notice unless you look really close. So the fact that 3 of the blocks match and then one's a little bit off, you don't even notice once they're all laid out. The second problem I had was lots of bias edges. Now, again, you cut your strips are not on the bias, but then you're cutting them at an angle when you trim off the whole square and when you're squaring it up. So all of the outside part of your square is a bias edge, unless you then go on and keep adding things and end up with a straight edge at the end. But most of the time, our blocks were all bias edges. So I frequently had very wonky blocks. I ended up, I had to block the hay out of them. So here's some tips if you've never had to block a square, which that's amazing if you haven't. There are ironing boards out there with ironing board covers that have the markings and have the grid lines. I don't have that. For some reason, that's just money I haven't wanted to spend yet. I am going to do it eventually because they are very handy. My mom had one, and I used to sometimes take stuff out to her house just so I could use it. But in lieu of doing that, you can draw a square the size that your blocks are supposed to end up being and just pin that to your ironing board. And then you lay your block on the outline and you try to pin it to the edge of that square, and then you press the heck out of it with a ton of seam to see if you can smidge it to size. You pin it all the way around, you give it another really good hit with steam, and then you lay as many really heavy and flat books on top of it to hold it as it dries. Now, technically, you shouldn't have to do this if all your cutting and piecing was completely accurate, but sometimes it might come to this, and I make no apologies. Okay, problem number two. What if your blocks don't end up all the same size? And mine didn't. And they were like way off. So there's some approaches you can take if your blocks don't end up all the same size. The first approach you can take is to start over. Repiece the blocks. My opinion, I'm not going to do it. Once I've already spent so much time putting those blocks together, unless I'm making an heirloom quilt, which I have not even wanted to touch doing yet, I'm not going to start over. So I need to come up with some other alternative solution. Your second approach is to cut them all down to match the smallest block. So you measure all your blocks, you figure out which one is the smallest one, and then you cut them all down to that size. For some kinds of blocks, that works fine. In my case, I would have lost way too many points doing it that way, so I couldn't do that either. So the third approach is to use what are called coping strips or coping triangles. And they're called coping because you're coping with the fact that all of your squares aren't the same size. Now, there's two books I really want to recommend for this. If you've been a quilter of any time at all, you should have at least one of these books, if not both, on your shelf. The first is Sharon Craig's Setting Solutions. It's an older book, but it's an amazing book. You need to get it. Sharon is spelled Sharyn, Craig, Craig, and the book is named Setting Solutions. And then the second book is from Rodale's Successful Quilting series, and the particular book is Sensational Sets and Borders. Every book in that series is a must-have, but that was the one that I used particularly on this quilt. I will make sure I post links to both of those in the show notes as well. I consulted both of them for ideas, and I found in the Setting Solutions book a very simple math formula for making the coping triangles. Now, the reason I chose triangles rather than squares was because when I was laying my blocks out on the on my design wall, I decided I really liked the way they looked on point. And I thought I would probably have a little more room for fudging if I did everything on point and did setting triangles instead of doing the coping strips around the outside. So the way you decide, this was so simple. Once I found the math, I knew I kind of wanted to do this triangle thing, and then I looked up the math in Sharon Craig's Setting Solutions book, and it was so easy. It was amazing. Basically, what you do is you cut two squares of the fabric you're going to use for your coping triangles. You cut two squares that are the same size as your block itself. You cut each of those squares diagonally, corner to corner, just once. So you're cutting each square in half. And then you sew the resulting triangles onto the sides of the blocks. You sew two opposite sides first. You press those, being really careful not to, knock stuff out of whack again. And then you sew the remaining two on. You press them all up again. And then you decide what size you want these blocks to be, and you trim them all to size. So I went from having squares that were all over the place in terms of size to having exact 9.5-inch squares for all of them. Now, when you look at them closely, are some of the points in the squares a little closer to the outside edge than others? Yeah, but you don't see it when they're all together. That's the magic of it. You would have to actually look at it closely with a ruler to really notice that these things are as far off as they are. Once you put them in those setting triangles, you don't see it. It was just beautiful. That was probably the main step that made me decide I could actually live with this quilt. So, again, if you have blocks that aren't all the same size, yeah, you can start over, you can redo them, or you can cut them all down to match that smallest block, or you can use the method of using coping strips or triangles. And I would recommend the strips or triangles because that was just such an easy way to do it. Now, however, once I decided to do that, that led me to problem number three. I didn't have enough fabric for coping triangles. I had already picked out two possible fabrics to use for these triangles. And actually, the two fabrics were an identical print, but they were in two different shades. And I'm using that word right. I learned that word when I had to do my episode on color. One was a light cream, and the other one was a couple of shades darker, so it was more of a light tan or beige, but they were the same tone-on-tone print. And I had hung them both on my design wall with the blocks for a few days, just wondering which one I was going to use, and I ultimately then decided on the lighter of the two, but then I did the math for how much I was going to need for the coping triangles for all these blocks, and I didn't have enough of either one. Now, taking the premise that there is no such thing as a mistake, it is just a design opportunity, I decided to use both fabrics, and I alternated them in the layout. Okay, so that was, you know, a relatively easy problem to solve, and actually, again, made the quilt even more interesting than it would have been to begin with. But that led to problem number four. Now I really needed sashing. I had all the coping triangles. I squared everything off to the same size. Like I said, I think it was somewhere around a 9.5 unfinished block at that point. But looking at them all just laying next to each other was terrible. So I decided I really needed to do a sashing. So I went through my stash again, and I had a really pretty blue, and I had a really nice brown, and I couldn't decide. I was leaning towards the brown, but I still liked the blue. Well, then I decided to do the math, and I didn't have quite enough of the brown to do all the sashing. I was just a scant short. But I didn't want to give up on the blue, and I decided I really didn't want all blue sashing either. So what I decided to do was use both. I did brown sashing with cornerstone stars in blue. Now, it's a really simple process to do the star cornerstones, but it's really pokey to do. You cut your sashing strips to the same length as the sides of your square, and then you cut your cornerstones to a square that's the same width of your sashing strips. So if you cut your sashing strips 2.5 inches wide, unfinished, your corner would then be a 2.5 inch square. Okay, that math is pretty easy. And then you cut a bazillion little squares that you sew on the corners of each end of the sashing strip to form the star points. And I'm sorry, I did not write down for myself the math that I did to figure out how big those corner squares were going to have to be. But I don't remember it being all that hard. I found it somewhere, so you can probably look on the internet and find it too. I think I had to cut something like 372 of those stupid little squares and then sew every one of those suckers onto the sashing strips. I don't remember the actual numbers now. I think I tried to block it out because that step took me for freaking ever. But that's what made the quilt for me. I love those star cornerstones. Love it, and it was such a thrill to see that all come together. I sewed the sashing strips to the side of each block, and then I sewed the rows of the blocks together. I then pieced the horizontal sashes, so the sashing strips that would go, you know, between the bottom and the top of the rows, I pieced those with their cornerstones, so I then had a long strip of sashing. And then, you know, you piece a row of blocks to a horizontal strip, and you just make sure that you pin the cornerstones exactly where they need to be and then ease everything in around them. So I always start pinning in the center and work my way out, but I start with where I need my corners to match. So I would start in the center blocks, pin the cornerstones there to where they needed to match up with the sashing strips above them, and then I'd go to the next block, to the next outside cornerstone, and I'd pin that, and then I'd look. If there was any fullness whatsoever in the sashing in the middle, I would just pin it in. Now, because of the way I had done these blocks with the setting squares, I had almost no problem with this sashing whatsoever because all of those blocks had been cut exactly the same size, and all my sashing strips had been cut exactly the same size. So this quilt probably was the easiest sashing I ever did. Everything matched up perfectly. I had very little fullness to have to ease in, and trust me, I've often had a lot of fullness I've had to ease in. This was the first time it really worked that beautifully for me. So, you know, I was really kind of proud of myself at that point. The other thing I tend to do, and I'm not sure why I do this, I'm not sure if someone somewhere along the way told me to do this or if I just figured out it was easiest to do this, I'll piece all the rows together. So then I've got all the rows on my design wall. And then I will tend to start piecing rows together until the last seam is in the center of the quilt. So I will do, you know, like the top two rows together, next two rows together, next two rows. And then I will take the top four rows, you know, and sew that middle seam, and then the bottom ones and sew that middle seam so that the last seam I do is the one in the middle. And I think I do that because of the way it fits into my sewing machine, but it's possible that somebody told me that was the way to do it for a reason. I don't really remember that now. But if you've often struggled with what order to do it in, try it that way and see if that works for you. Okay, so now I've got the whole center pieced together, and I really like it, but I've got a whole lot of fabric going on. Again, this was scrappy. It was the first time I was doing scrappy, so I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to do for a border. This was problem number 5. And by the way, each one of these problems resulted in the quilt sitting for several weeks. So I took the class in 2008 to spring of 2009. It started June 2008, ended in June 2009. We were supposed to have the top pieced by November 2009, and I didn't have mine pieced by that point yet. And then I just finally got it pieced together about maybe 6 weeks ago and dropped it off at the quilter and just got it back. So this has been how long this process has been. Okay, so back to problem number 5. What the heck was I going to do for a border? I folded up the piece top with me and brought it to the first fabric store. Couldn't find anything that worked. Went to the second fabric store, which was larger, had more fabric. I figured, oh, if I can find it anywhere, I'll be able to find it at this store. And I could not find anything anywhere. Was about to give up, and then I had the brainstorm. Well, wait a minute. Almost all of the fat quarters I had used were from Moda lines, because I'm a Moda girl, so I tend to drift towards Moda fabric. So I looked around the quilt store that I was in, and I recognized some other sets of Moda coordinates on one set of shelves. So I went over and I looked at it more carefully. So here was my assumption. A fabric company will tend to keep repeating similar tones and color schemes through at least a certain time period. In other words, once they find something that sells well, they're going to keep at it, even though they tweak it up for the seasons and changing times. So you may not be able to find the same fabric print or, exactly the same set of coordinates from a fabric line, but chances are, if you stick with the same manufacturer, you're probably going to find something else that'll have the same tones and shades, etc. And bingo, right there on the shelves was the perfect border fabric. It was another Moda. It was a different line, but it was exactly the same tones and color schemes as the fat quarters that I'd used. And then I got to problem number 6. Okay, so I had the borders on there. How would I ever get this thing done? Now, by now, I had decided I actually really liked this quilt, darn it. That was a real evolution for me. And I left it on my design wall for some time trying to consider quilting patterns. But the problem here was threefold. One, I'm not a hand quilter. At this stage in my life, I just don't have the patience, and I don't choose to spend the time on that with my current life circumstances. Eventually, I do want to do some hand quilting, not there yet. Number two, my machine quilting skills are definitely improving, but I am still definitely limited by them. So the things I envision in my head, I can only rarely actually do on the sewing machine. And then three, my machine quilting setup is great for wall hangings, but it's not so much so for bedside quilts. I can do it, but I don't really enjoy it. It's hard to manhandle that quilt through there. So ultimately, I decided if I ever wanted to get this thing done, I was going to have to contract it out to an expert. Now, you may have just listened to episode 16, in which I chat with a long-arm quilter and my conversation with Tara Tom. We talked in that episode about people's hang-ups using a professional quilter. Here's the thing. I used to feel guilty about having a long-arm quilter. I think we tend to live in this world of you're not a real quilter unless you take every last dang stitch with your own hands. But then I realized that most professional quilters out there hire long-arm quilters on a regular basis, or they'd never get anything done. I also realized that a lot of the award-winning quilts that I was looking at in quilt shows were actually a team effort. The designer, the piecer, the quilter, all working together. Everybody has their gifts. We don't necessarily have to kill ourselves to do every last step just so we can be proud of the finished product. Whenever I use someone else's pattern, in essence, I've already contracted out the design work. So why should I have a hang-up about contracting out expert services and quilting? Now, that's not to say I'm definitely going to be trying to continue to improve my skills. And I've definitely toyed with the notion of learning how to do long arm work myself. I do, after all, have a basement, and feasibly, eventually, it just really is crying out for a long arm machine. But I'm just not there yet, skill-wise or investment-wise. I think I've mentioned before, 2 college tuitions. So in any case, in terms of machine hiring out to a long arm quilter, I did finally get over myself. So for now, periodically, I give myself permission to help support someone else's family or someone else's career dreams by availing myself of their skills, expertise, and artistic eye. And in this case, man, did it pay off. I took it to a machine quilter I've used before and dropped it off. And they actually told me at the time that I probably wouldn't get it back until the end of August because they were that backed up. But they have two women at this quilt store that kind of trade off the machine quilting. And one woman happened to be in the store the day I dropped it off, and the store owner went to go get her and have her come look at this quilt. And she looked at it immediately, oh, I could do this there, and I could do this over thing there. And having those coping triangles, by the way, the store owner said we refer to those as show-off triangles because that's where the quilting all happens. And I will post some photos of this probably on my quiltingfortherestofus.blogspot.blog.com. Because that one handles photos better than the Podbean one does, but I'll post some close-up photos. But she just did a beautiful job. There's each of the blocks, like I said, the center of the block, the parts that is actually the square and the square technique block, has a medallion sort of quilt style in it, and then she did a feathered wreath around the outside of each of those blocks in the setting squares. She did in the sashing, she did this great sort of swirly pattern that I'm sure it's got a name. I don't know what it is. And then in the cornerstones, because again, remember there are sort of square stars there, she did this great sort of starburst pattern in each one of those cornerstones. And then the border is a feathered wreath, and it just, oh, it's just gorgeous. And it's nothing I could have ever done myself at this stage in my career. You know, a couple more years, a little more practice, yeah, I could probably get there. But frankly, I want to get my UFOs done. I don't want them on my shelf for 2 years waiting for me to learn how to get good enough to do this. So I am just thrilled. I do still have to get the binding on this quilt now, but it is so close. By the end of the summer, a 2-year project in the making will be done, and I will have fallen in love with it. So let this be a cautionary tale to you. I know I usually tell you that you should feel okay about giving up on something that's just not working for you. It is only fabric after all. And I do still believe that, you know, if you're doing something because you want to learn a new technique or you're trying something out and it's just not working, don't kill yourself. Give yourself permission to say, okay, I've learned what I could learn from this project. I need to move on and do something else with it or get rid of it altogether. But you know what this quilt taught me is that it's also sometimes okay not to give up. Trust yourself. Trust your instincts. Keep finding creative ways to make your mistakes come out all right in the end. That's what I learned from this quilt. I learned so much from the process. I especially learned so much about setting. And, you know, again, I can't say enough about Sharon Craig's book, Setting Solutions. It's a must-have for every quilter, in my opinion. And the Rodale book on setting sensational sets and borders is also a must-have book. Any of those Rodale books are. So make sure you avail yourself of those expert opinions and ideas and suggestions. And you know what? If you just don't want to give up on something, trust yourself and you'll be able to pull it off in the end. And please, you know, in your comments or in the Big Tent group or wherever, email me or whatever, tell me your stories of mistakes that you were able to turn into design opportunities or quilts or projects that you hated but ended up loving at the end. Because I think sometimes that is just so much fun to hear from other folks because it gives us so much hope for our own projects that we're hating at the moment or we're very frustrated with. So in any case, talk to me, please, always. That's it for this episode. I really hope you were inspired. Now, I have mentioned this before, but I wanted to just reiterate it. I now skip town for a couple of weeks. So unless some miracle happens, there will not be a Quilting for the Rest of Us podcast episode next week. And then the one for the week after that will probably be a couple of days late because I typically record these on a Thursday night and I come home on a Thursday and chances are I'm going to be asleep. So it might take me a couple of days to get another episode posted, but it will be posted. So we're really only skipping 1 week. You might have to wait a couple of extra days for that second one. So, you know, don't miss me too much. But don't forget to sign up for the newsletter. And please leave comments at the show blog or on my blogspot.com blog. Again, quilter, http://quilter.podbean.com is the show blog. and you will find links to everything else there. So if that's all you can remember, remember that. The other ones are quiltingfortherestofus.blogspot.com. That's my quilty life blog. You can also follow me on Twitter so I can follow you, and you can always email me. Twitter and my email address are the same thing, Sandy Quilts, Sandy with a Y, Quilts with a Z, and the email is at gmail.com. And again, those of you who have posted reviews at iTunes, thank you so much. You've been so kind. I really appreciate it. And if others, if you would like to do that too, that would be a wonderful help. And by the way, while I'm gone, throw me a lifeline. I will need some quilty happiness while I'm away immersed in work. So keep talking to me, please. So until the long time next time, go get your quilty on. Quilting for the Rest of Us is dedicated to Shirley. Love you, Mom.